Silence.
Oppenheimer.
I think they're talking about us. No way.
I myself am strange and unusual.
This is Nerf Right Radio.
Nerd alert.
These nerds are a threat to our way of life.
See, this is the stuff that brings nerds together.
So it's sort of social. Demented and sad, but social, right?
If I'm interested in it, then by definition, it is nerdy.
Are you in loser denial or something?
I'm a nerd, and I'm pretty proud of it.
My dad's a nerd.
And welcome to episode 38 of Nerd Pride Radio. 38, the official number of minutes a Stargate can remain open. So, ask me how I'm doing today. Go on, ask me. I am awesome. My name is Mike Jones, and I'm a D&D nerd, a history nerd, a sci-fi nerd, comic book nerd, computer nerd, movie nerd, comedy nerd, science nerd, gaming nerd. Plus, there's probably like seven other kinds of nerd. I only wish I was nerdy enough to be. You're listening to Nerd Pride Radio, the place I go every week to haver on about all the nerd stuff that just won't fit in my head anymore. As always, you're listening to the best-smelling podcast on the internet. That's right. Nerd Pride Radio smells like the 4% of the internet that doesn't involve porn. If I could smell anything, which I can't, maybe you've noticed from my voice, got a little upper respiratory thing going on, something here, a little cough, a little cold. So we'll see how long this podcast is going to be. We'll see how long my voice holds out. I'm doing my best. It's for you, because I love you. Okay, but the first thing we're going to do is move right into the meticulously plotted portion of this podcast. This is the time for me where I talk about whatever's been on my mind for the last week. If something strikes me as interesting during the course of my busy, busy week, I add it to my master list, and then the best stuff gets spewed out all over you guys every week when I record. You lucky dogs. And the very first thing on my master list, updates. Yeah, update. I told you I read Song of Ice and Fire, all five books, the first ones. Okay, I just checked, and it turns out that book six isn't out yet. Oh, I don't know if I can wait this long. But, you know what else it's time for? That's right, it's time for yet another installment of our all-too-frequent segment, Mike Was Wrong! And last episode, one of the Podomatic questions was about G.I. Joe, and my favorite G.I. Joe. And in the course of answering that question, I mistakenly referred to the Baroness as the Countess. Yeah, I did. And you know what? None of you caught it. You know why? Because I used the magic of audio editing to remove it. I caught it first while I was going through the editing. I went, God, that's not right. And I took it out. And that way you guys didn't hear it in the finished product. And now the guilt of it has been consuming me all week long. It's been driving me crazy that I deceived you, my loyal listeners, in such a fashion. So I apologize. Yes, I know the Baroness's name. Yes, I think she's really hot. I can't believe I screwed that up in the podcast, and I can't believe I tried to hide it from you guys. You know what? Our relationship is based on honesty and trust, and I promise I will try to never, ever do that again.
Don't know much about history.
And that music means it's time for my unnamed history segment. Okay, this is going to be a little bit disjointed, and I know it is. And I apologize in advance. This is just another one of my Wikipedia rabbit hole adventures. I was researching some mythology stuff. Last week, you'll remember that I talked about the oh, damn it, now I've forgotten the word. Oh, that's right. The Kairi from Greek myth versus the Valkyrie of Norse myth. And anyway, I've been doing a lot of mythology research as in the course of this last week, just because it's fascinating to me. And one of the things that occurred to me this week is that I know all sorts of stuff about Greek and Roman myth, and I also know a whole bunch of stuff about Norse myth, and then that's about it. As far as the rest of the world goes, I've got little snippets of bits and pieces here, but, you know, the the cucumber girl of Southeast Asia. I'd never heard of her before. And so I thought to myself, you know what, let's make a concerted effort to actually just do a little bit of research on mythologies of other cultures. And where did I start? I started with India. India. Because I am fascinated by India lately. They have over 1 billion people in that tiny, tiny little country. I know it's not that tiny, but it's only like a third of the size of the U.S., and they've got 1 billion-something people in there. And Indian culture just fascinates me. So I'm doing a little bit of research on Indian myth, and of course they are such a huge, diverse population that it covers a lot of stuff. Vedic myth, Hindi myth, Buddhist myth. There's all sorts of other stuff mixed in there. And I started right back in the beginning. I decided I would go back to the, 5,000 years ago, early Vedic myth, looking at the early Indian gods. And India itself seems so exotic. It's so otherworldly to me in some ways. And so that's part of my fascination with it, I think, is that they're becoming such a modern nation, and more easily accessible because there's so many English speakers there, that you can find a lot of people who are Indian or of Indian heritage, who are, writing and publishing stuff in English. There's a lot of very coherent material out there. And so juxtaposing this exotic image that I've always had in my head of what, traditional stereotypical Indian culture looks like versus the modern thing that you're seeing nowadays in their movies and their other media just fascinates me. So I'm looking at early Vedic myth. Not to ramble too far afield here. And as it turns out, as I start reading their myths, one, I got lost really quickly. It's like trying to read Genesis. The names are coming at you so fast, and my mind isn't geared to sort out Indian names as well as I do more European-style names or other stuff like that. I'm starting to get some of it, but it's just not sticking in my memory. And it all looks so familiar. And I realize that, for example, as I'm looking at Surya, the early Vedic god of the sun, goes by several names over time. But one of the first myths I find about Surya is him. He had apparently two wives, at least, that I had looked at. And his very first wife, after they get married, Surya's wife discovers that she can't bear the brightness of his being. He is, after all, the god of the sun, and the rays of light and heat coming off him are just overwhelming for her. So what's her response to that? Well, she decides to create an image of herself. She creates a false version of herself, and I don't have her name written down, so I can't remember what it was. But she creates a false version of herself, and then being, a god, she imbues that image with life, and it leaves it behind as kind of a fake mannequin wife for Surya so that he won't know the difference. And then she makes for the hills. And then ultimately, as the story goes on, she is later transformed into a mare and then adopted back into Surya's household. So he is now her owner. And apparently she, in mare form, doesn't have the godlike ability to transform herself back or get the hell out of there. And as I'm reading it, I realized, that story would not be at all out of place in Greek or Roman myth. That story, apparently, ancient mythos has a lot of stuff in common. I mean, it just seems very, very familiar. You know what I'm saying? So I go a little further, and Surya's sons, he had many children, but he had twin sons, the Ashvins, and I don't know their individual names, but they were the Ashvins. And I'm going to, by the way, all the way through this discussion, because I'm going to go from Vedic and Hindi myth, I'm going to go into some Arabic myth, and some other stuff I found. And I am going to butcher pronunciations horribly through the entire thing, and I accept that, and I'm not even going to try, because I'm doing my best. All right. Anyway, the Ashvins, his twin sons, they are sunrise and sunset. They are horsemen gods. And immediately, when you think horsemen gods, well, maybe you don't, but I think of Castor and Pollux from Greek myth. And sure enough, get to the very end of the article on the Ashvins. This is all Wikipedia. Everything I've got here, just go read Wikipedia. Follow the same links I did. At the very end of that article, it says, compared to Castor and Pollux. They're very analogous. And so, sure enough, you link over to Castor and Pollux, and they're the same dudes. They just happen to be, some are a little darker skinned is all. And so I kind of trailed off with following gods at that point from India, because it was getting to the point where I realized, okay, I've seen a lot of these stories before, and I don't know what I was looking for, but I wanted something cool and different. And so I started going into mythological beasts. And the Indians got some cool ones that we don't have. First off, the Rakshasa, who you guys, if you play D&D, you know the Rakshasa because they're tiger-headed demon-type people who devour flesh, and they're very, very evil. In real life, Rakshasa, or just Raksha or Raksha is the other simpler name for me. The Rakshas are simply demons that devour human flesh. I mean, that's really about it. The tales of them are so varied that, sometimes they take animal form. Their natural form is described as being giants who devour human flesh. But, they're possibly wizards, possibly shape changers, possibly a million different things, because the myths have been around for thousands of years and passed through thousands, if not millions, of different hands before the tellings that have gotten down to us. But they're just demons, all right? But the illustrations of them are pretty awesome. And then from that, the Pisaka or Pisacha, I don't know how to pronounce that one either, they're like ghoulish vampires. They're not described as undead, although the modern interpretation of them is undead. But yeah, essentially ghouls that hunt around graveyards, and they devour dead human flesh. They drink the blood of the living. Apparently devouring human flesh is a really popular pastime among supernatural beings. I suppose that was our fear, is that they were going to come and devour us in the night. But, God, they had tigers for that. You would think they already had plenty of demons right there. But the stories are still around today. I mean, we still have vampires, we still have ghouls, we still have zombies. The undead, the walking dead, the demons coming around to eat our flesh, our brains, our blood. Pretty consistent theme. But my favorite, absolute favorite, and I told you this would be disjointed and rambling, you're just going to have to deal with that. My favorite of the beasts from the Indian myths that I looked at was the Makara. These guys are awesome. All right, I don't know if you remember from first edition Dungeons & Dragons. In the first edition Dungeons & Dragons Monster Manual, there was the Hippocampus. All right, the Hippocampus was a merhorse, essentially. It was the front half horse with four legs, head, the full thing, flowing mane, and then back half fish, all right? And it was a mount for the Tritons, the Tritons were the mer people in D&D that didn't have a fish tail anyway. Hippocampi also served as a wonderful supernatural mount for aquatic paladins, or however you wanted to do it. But I loved the Hippocampus. I loved that in the Monster Manual. There was something about that horsefish thing that just drew me in. And I actually did a couple of full-color pictures. I don't know if it was for art class or just because I was... But I drew Hippocampi. I loved that creature. Never found a good use for it in a game, but I designed characters that, and then when he gets high enough level, I'm going to go out and find one of these. That's going to be my ride. Not realizing that, like Aquaman, there's only so much you're going to do in aquatic adventures in Dungeons & Dragons. It's really, all the action's really on land. But it was so cool at the time. All right, so back to the Makara. Makara are the same sort of thing, but with an Indian flavor to them. And Makara are, in general, all half mammal, front half mammal, back half fish. And they can take lots of, or back half alligator sometimes, or maybe sometimes front half alligator, back half fish. They kind of mix it up a little. But the best one, the absolute best one, is the half elephant, half fish. That's the one I love. And that's used for the mount, as the mount of at least a couple of different gods that I saw. And they're just cool. All right. And most of their traditional renderings of it look pretty grotesque. They're pretty gruesome creatures because the elephant head is really stylized and it's not full elephant, like the ears are missing or the trunk is misshapen or whatever. But if you look at more modern interpretations and modern renderings, the mer elephant is just badass. I love the idea of the mer elephant. And where the traditional renderings are often fish with an elephant's head slapped on the front, more modern renderings tend to go with that whole hippocampus effect that I like, with this big old massive sea serpent fish body, and then the elephant's whole front half. So you've got the elephant's forelegs, the full trunk with the tusks coming out. Just the coolest thing in the world. And I don't know why I'm so in love with this creature, but it was really cool. And it was something, and again, it's something that, I mean, just this week, I'm just flipping around because I decided I needed an education on Indian myth, and I didn't get a very good one, by the way. I read lots of interesting tidbits here and there, Wikipedia link. I went out to some sites that had summaries, but some of they had lots of conflicting information, and some of them were very poorly written. But here, I'm going out and I'm looking, and I stumble across something that I just didn't know before, and it was just cool. And so I just really liked it. If I could get myself a t-shirt with a really cool stylized mer elephant on it, I would certainly do that, because they're badass, I am telling you. So that's not the end of my dive into religion here. I then was looking at one of these articles linked to, it said, see also jinn, J-I-N-N, jinn as in genies, in D&D at least, the jinn is the general name for it, and then genie and efreet and all the other types of genies that are out there, or jinn. And so I linked to jinn, and I'm reading it, and it turns out jinn is not so much a Hindi or Indian legend, but has existed in Arabic culture for ages. Thus, you know, our constant association with it, with the genie, with Aladdin, and 1001 Arabian Nights, and that kind of stuff. And the jinn are essentially otherworldly spirits. They, or people, from another realm of existence or another phase of existence. It's never quite clear, because, again, things shift so much over time. And among them, if you take it from the Arabian Nights tales, you wind up with like they have from D&D, they've stolen straight across. The Merid would be the water jinn, with water-based powers. The Efreet, who are born of fire, and they're ruthless and evil. And they're the ones that, with both of these, you can make deals with them, you can get wishes from them, but getting a wish from them usually requires doing combat with them, or capturing them, or performing some other probably soul-endangering ritual of some sort. But they will grant you wishes if you're willing to take that chance. And then, even cooler, well, I don't know if they're... You know what? This is all cool as in the eye of the beholder here. But let me just tell you, I was impressed. Grine. G-R-I-N-E. Grine. I have never heard of them. Never even... Nothing. But the Grine are jinn who are linked to a human being in some way. They're like your genie doppelganger of you, born at the same time, die at the same time. Your actions and theirs are inextricably linked, and what happens to you affects them in some way. So it's your evil Spock. It's your otherworldly, because also, by the way, they all have mustaches, unless you do, in which case they don't, obviously. But anyway, fascinating stuff. And so along with the jinn, and I went, and I didn't find, and I guess, I suppose, hold on, I've got Google. I'm going to put you on pause for just a second here. Okay, I looked it up. Wikipedia does nothing for me in this case. I was going to say, the stuff that I read didn't mention anything about the other D&D jinn that are listed, the Dao and then the straight-up genie, which is the Dao would be the earth genies, and the jinn would, the genies would be the air ones, based on the again, traditional rendering of what we think of as a genie. When you think of Aladdin and his lamp, you think of an air genie. That's just the way we depict them in Western art, at least. Yeah, I don't know about Arabic art. But is there Arabic art now? Because you're not allowed to have images of human beings. Can you have images of jinn? Can you do that? I don't know what's allowable. Anyway, sorry, just expressing my ignorance there. But then once we get to Muhammad and Islam and all of this, the jinn are then incorporated into the Quran. I did not know that. That according to the Quran, God created three types of beings. All right. See, in the Judeo-Christian Bible, he creates angels and he creates man. In the Quran, he actually created three. There was mankind. There were the jinn. Who are our otherworldly counterparts. They just put them out there, and they're magical beings. They're generally immortal. But they also have free will, as man does. Man and jinn both have free will. Angels, the third one, which we also have in Christianity, angels in the Quran were created to be purely divine, and they lacked free will. So jinn would be the divine agents who do have free will. And thus, in their story, Satan, Shaitan, however you want to put it, Iblis, whatever you want to call him, then when he falls from grace, he is a jinn, so he has free will. He can choose to go against God. Whereas in Christian myth, it's not quite as clearly explained, because you would think that angels don't have free will, but if they don't have free will, then how did Satan go and rebel against God, Lucifer, in this case? How did he rebel against God in the first place? Or did they have free will, and then God removed that after the rebellion? Because there's some that say that. There's others that say, no, angels have always had free will. But it's not the kind of wavering thing that human beings have, where we sin and then we redeem ourselves and then we sin again and then we try better. And then, all right, with angels, it would be, and this is again, according to some Christian theorists, with angels, it would be an all or nothing thing. Either you choose to obey God's will, submit yourself to God's will at all times. You've either chosen to be purely good or you reject God. And once you've made that choice to reject God, it's done. It's done for all time. There is no redemption for angels. There is no coming back. So it's basically just an on-off switch. So either you have submitted completely, in which case you are that tool of God who effectively has no free will. You're merely doing exactly what God wants at all times. Or you've made the choice, as Satan and his followers did, to simply shut it off and go, nope, not going to do it. And thus, you are now completely out of God's grace. No chance of going back. Again, Islamic, the Quran, very similar, but again, the angels themselves, no, they're always pure and perfect. They're nothing but divine automatons to obey God's will, whereas the jinn, that's where the ones have free will. And there are some jinn who stayed and some jinn who left. And the ones who left, oh, but hey, this was cool. In the Quran, rather than being cast immediately to hell, God condemned Satan and his followers to an eternity of hellfire, and Satan said, well, okay, but if I tell you I'm really, really sorry, will you wait until Judgment Day to send us there? And God, being infinitely merciful, said, okay, you've got until Judgment Day. But then after Judgment Day, when I've passed my judgment across all of mankind, living and dead, then at that point you will also be judged and you're going to hell and you're not coming back. And Satan said, okay, thanks. In the meantime, I'm going to spend the rest of my days until Judgment Day trying to subvert your followers and lead them down the wrong path. Which, God, yeah, it would be just like Satan to twist a deal like that. You know what I'm saying? Here, God's being nice, going, all right, you know what? You said you're sorry. I'll give you a break. You've got till Judgment Day. All right, well, I'll see how much more evil I can pile on before then. Which then leads to, among the jinn in the Quran, among the jinn who have fallen, there are the Quareen. Quareen, I don't know the pronunciations. Again, I'm ignorant. And it's essentially like Christians have, some Christians have a big thing with their guardian angel, all right? In Islam, they have a counterpart to that, the Quareen, which is your shoulder devil. So when you see in the cartoons and you've got the angel on the one shoulder and the devil on the other shoulder, the devil's up there whispering to you to do all the selfish, horrible, bad things. Well, in Islam, that has a name. That's the Quareen. That is your shoulder devil, who is literally a fallen jinn who then comes back to visit you, and he sticks with you personally. He's assigned to you at birth by Satan, I would presume. They must have some kind of hierarchy. And it's his job your entire life to try and entice you to do evil. All right, that's all he does, just like in the cartoons. And to go along with that, Muhammad, again, according to the Quran, like any other human being, had a Quareen who was assigned to him, and his Quareen is the only one in all of history who was ever converted to Islam. Yeah, how powerful is that? All right, I am so good that I can take my shoulder devil and turn him into a good guy. Which, by the way, he's still, that Muhammad's chlorine is still condemned, I think, for all time, because I don't think Jin get the same redemption that humanity can get. But he became a believer in the faith and a believer in God and Islam and the whole business. And I found that fascinating. So, oh, all right, wait. One last thing. I've heard many times the number of named people in the Bible, for example, and they talk about how, you know, they say something like, you know, there's hundreds upon hundreds of men named in the Bible through the generations. We follow through Genesis and other books that you get, you know, son of, and they go down the line. And then they'll mention, okay, there's several hundred men named by name in the Bible. How many women are named in the Bible? And then it's always a number like 13, all right, or some ridiculously low number in comparison to the number of men. And yes, I have Google open right here. I'm not going to look. All right, go find it out for yourself if you're that interested. But to make a comparison to that, how many women are mentioned by name in the Quran? Any guess? One. Exactly one. All right. That, I don't know if that surprised me or not, because what was more surprising to me is, do you know who? Mary. Mary, mother of Jesus? Yeah. Yeah, the only woman named in the Quran. In fact, so important to the Islamic faith that she has a whole chapter of the Quran named after her, because she is the holiest woman in the Quran. She's the holiest woman among many Islamic believers. Muslims revere Mary as a very holy person. I was amazed. I've always known that Jesus, and one would presume Mary, but I always knew that Jesus was mentioned in the Quran. I always knew that Muslims believed that Jesus was a prophet, and they believed that Jesus was a very holy person. They just deny his divinity, and they claim that he was just a man, a very holy man, but just a man. I did not realize the status that they really gave him, though. I mean, in the Quran, if you read through it, and I own a Quran, and I've tried to read the Quran, but the problem is I tried to read the Quran from the beginning, and it's like trying to read the Bible from the beginning. There's some interesting parts, and there's some really boring parts. And I had a lot of trouble sinking my teeth into it, and this is many, many years ago. And then I just kind of let it go. But apparently, if you find the right sections, yeah, you find the whole story of Mary told more than a little differently than the Bible tells it, but the same essentials that you know, Mary was a virgin, and the angels came to her, and they told her that she would be having the Son of God, and through the power of the Holy Spirit, or whatever the Islamic equivalent of that is, the life was placed within her. She bore a child while still a virgin. And that, by the way, even before that, they make the claim that God created Mary to be completely untouched by sin. Completely untouched by sin, and which I thought was just a Christian/Catholic thing. To be believing that, but apparently no. The Quran says the exact same thing, that she was created by God without sin, and then thus, as a result, since she was untouched by man, when Jesus came, Jesus was also born without sin, and thus was extremely holy and was a prophet of the Islamic faith. I just found that fascinating. Again, stuff that I should know. I really ought to know. Just as a denizen of this modern world, in a place where there's, you know, yes, we've got, you know, a billion something Catholics out in the world, but we've also got a billion something Muslims out there. We have there's so much going on in the world that I should know about, and I run across these tidbits, and one, I'm fascinated to learn them, but two, a little disappointed that I didn't know that already. You know, you feel like your public education should have prepared you for some of this. You know what I mean? It was odd. So anyway, my research continues. I probably won't bring it back to the podcast just because this is 2 weeks in a row that I've done mythic stuff. But, you know, we'll see what I come across. And now it's time for the Science Corner.
Ooh, she blinded me with science.
She blinded me with science.
Blinded me with science.
And that music means if you don't walk away now, you might be in danger of learning something. This is going to be a short one. Really minor, because, you know, I've always said that this podcast is not about religion or politics. I just don't feel that that has much of a place in what I'm doing. Those are divisive issues, and I don't want to be divisive. I just want to talk about cool nerd stuff. So, having just finished a discussion of religion, why don't I go straight into politics? As it turns out, the election is now over, and Barack Obama is our president, again, still. And the most important part about this is that now the election's over, I've looked at the final results, and it turns out that numbers still mean something. And I like that. All right? I don't care what your political leanings are. I don't care who you voted for. All I'm saying is the numbers work, and I'm so happy for that. I have been following with avid interest the polling for these, and there's been talk of, you know, which polls are biased and which polls aren't, and you know, what's the best algorithm for coming up with your compilation of the various polls and doing aggregates and all of this. Nate Silver's been really big talking about his predictions based on the numbers. I go to electoralvote.com is the one that I follow pretty much the whole election season, and I like seeing the flow between the red and the blue. And also, I followed the Senate stuff and the House stuff, but mostly looking at just the presidential map. Every couple of days, go in, check the presidential map, see if it's moved a little bit, what the numbers are running. And the entire election season, the polls, when you look at these aggregators, when you look at these ones that do summaries and compilations of all the polls, they've been showing Obama's going to win since the beginning. All right, there's only been like once that it came close to being a tie game, and then quickly separated again with Obama pulling out in the lead. And the later ones were showing that, you know, Obama's going to win. You know, the numbers were like 200 and something for, you know, it was like 210 for Romney, 280 for Obama, and then here's the undecideds that are just too close for even us to call at this point. We'll tell you which way they kind of lean, but I mean, it was looking like it was going to be 300 to 250, something like that, 240, whatever the total is. And that's what it's been looking like for weeks now. But, you know, you hear all this talk of poll bias and, you know, how do they collect their data? You know, there's always this worry that, you know, okay, is there a certain political leaning who's more likely to talk to a pollster and not hang up on them? Are there, you know, since they're not allowed to call cell phones and we're leaving out all the people who only have a cell phone, does that mean we're cutting out a vital part of our constituency? Is there, you know, and so you worry. And then Crazy Elf does something like post how cheating voting machines are going to switch votes over to the Republicans at the last minute and steal the election. And so you worry. You're like, okay, you know, here I've been telling people all along that, yeah, based on these numbers, I'm pretty sure Obama's going to win. But, you know, at the very last second, what if it turns out that all of our polls are wrong? All of our science behind this is wrong? And it's, you know, it's not an exact science. It's polling. It's representative sampling. But if you've taken statistical analysis, you know, there's a certain confidence that can be imparted to this. And so there was just that sweating as we got towards the end, going, okay, have the polls meant anything all this time? And as it turns out, when you look at the final electoral map, yeah, it looks almost exactly like the map from the week before on electoralvote.com. The polls were dead on. Everything came out within a couple of percentage points of what they had predicted, which makes perfect sense. And it means that, hey, statistics is valid. our methods were valid, or their methods. I don't want to take any credit for this because I had nothing to do with it. I'm just an avid consumer. And so it was just reassuring to me to get to this point and go, yep, the numbers work. Okay, good. There's something that we can at least, we have some evidence now that we can have a little bit of faith in that. To know that, because last time, the last election, I followed electoralvote.com through the entire election, and sure enough, they were dead on that time too. But then you start to doubt. It's been 4 years. But everything turned out cool. Science is still good. What do we have up next?
And now for something completely different.
That's right, it's time for something completely different. This is just miscellaneous stuff that I don't really have a category for yet. And having done religion and then politics, hey, let's flip right back to religion. All right. This is me breaking my own rules for the entire episode. I guess I'm just that kind of guy. So I hear just today, just this morning, I hear that Bishop Fabian Breskowitz, the Catholic bishop of the Archdiocese of Lincoln, Nebraska, has just retired. Apparently, he's 77 years old. And did you know that when you're 75 and you're a bishop, at 75, by Catholic law, you need to submit your resignation to the Pope at the age of 75. And then he will decide when he's going to accept that resignation. And apparently, he's decided to accept it today. All right. Fabian Breskowitz has been the bishop in Lincoln, I think, for like 30 years. The guy's been there forever. And let me just say, I couldn't be happier to see the dude go. Really. This is, and the reason I bring it up, again, I'm not out to criticize religion in general, or the Catholic faith in particular, but it ties into my own experiences from earlier this week, where I'm traveling in the car with my 9-year-old son, Logue, and Logue is talking to me. We were talking about, Guy Gax's best friend, McDiddles. McDiddles' dad is a Lutheran minister, all right? He's a pastor. And we were talking about McDiddles and his dad because I had just worked the concession stand with the guy and we had a good time. We get along really well with him. They're a lot of fun. And Logue is asking me questions about him. So, yeah, but what does he do for a job? I'm like, well, as a job, he's a Lutheran minister. That's what he does. And that's a whole time, that's a full-time job? And he's like, yeah, well, you know. So I explained to Logue how, you know, the kind of duties that would be involved and how much work goes into it. I said duty. All right, so anyway, sorry. I will tell the story. Sidebar, I'll get back to Logue and his questions in just a minute. We were actually at a church function the other night, and there's a nun, I can't remember her name. She's up at the front, and she's doing this whole lecture, and we have a sheet of paper, a little outline of the talk in front of us, and my wife does this all the time. That if she's got something to comment on, she just jots it down on the paper, and then I can read it, and if I have a response, I'll write something down. So we're like kids passing notes in class. But we've done this at many different presentations and meetings and events and stuff, because you don't want to talk, but you also, you know, you want to communicate with your spouse. And so the nun, sister, whoever she is, gets on to talking about our duty as Christians, and Nadia leans over, and I knew she was going to do it, but it was still funny as all get out, leans over and writes on the paper, "She said duty." And then we both have a little private giggle with each other. My wife is so cool. Anyway, back to Logue. That's what I was talking about. So anyway, we're talking about Lutheran ministers. And so I make the comparison. I said, well, it's kind of like, you know, it's kind of like our priests, you know, except for the difference that priests can't get married. And obviously Lutheran ministers can because, well, his son McDiddles is friends with us. My son was just amazed. Just amazed. He said, wait. Priests can't get married? I'm like, yeah, no, they can't. You didn't know that? He's like, no, when did that happen? And so I start explaining church law. And I'm like, you know, it's not in the Bible anywhere. So other religions aren't wrong by allowing their ministers, their pastors, their priests to get married. There's nothing wrong with that for their religion. This is just something that the Catholic Church decided a long time ago, and I give the reasons behind it, and then I also tell him that, hey, you know what, it's something that will probably change in the future. In fact, when I first became Catholic, the priest who was teaching the catechism was a Father Witt down in Lincoln, Nebraska, in fact, and Father Witt explained to us in this class, he said, you know, yeah, priests can't get married right now, but that's just because the church has made that decision. He said, they can change their minds. And he said, more than likely, eventually, they will. He said, now, it's not going to be anytime soon, probably not in my lifetime, He said, but eventually there's going to be a big enough shortage of priests that they're going to kind of, they're going to have to reconsider their stuff. He said, just like, he said, before you see married priests, though, you're going to see women priests. He said, yeah, you know, we've always been really strict on that. He said, but there's nothing in the Bible that says a woman can't be a priest, and women would love to take a bigger role in their service to their church and to the people of the church. We have, he said, there are tons of Catholic women who would love the opportunity to become a priest and would do really well at it. And since we're only have about half the priests we need, this would go a long way towards filling that need, that we have all these willing people who just aren't allowed to serve. And so that was Father Witt. And he said, you know, eventually you'll see that coming. He said, you'll see women priests long before you see married priests. So he said, but I anticipate that both of them will eventually happen. And so I explained this to Logue as well. I'm telling him that I'm giving him exactly what I just told you guys about Father Witt and married priests, women priests. And then his eyes get even wider. He goes, wait a minute. Women can't be priests? I'm like, no, you've never seen a woman priest, have you? He says, well, no, not in our church, but, you know, on TV. And I'm like, yeah, but those are other religions. The Catholic Church says no. He goes, but that's wrong. I'm like, well, yeah, I agree with you. I understand that. And he says, do they realize that that's like telling women they can't vote? That's like telling black people they can't vote? Do they realize how wrong that is? I'm like, oh, if only from your mouth to the Pope's ears. Seriously, kiddo, I was so proud of him in that moment that his gut reaction to this is one of absolute moral outrage. And in his mind, it is such a cut and dried, simple matter that really all he needs to do is go explain it to the church, and then they'll fix it, because once he explains it to them, they'll understand. Oh, it was beautiful. It was a great little moment, and I was very, very proud of him. Because I'm not going to go into a big detailed discussion of my own personal faith, but suffice to say, I obviously don't agree with everything that the church says, but there's other factors involved there, and this is one where along with a lot of other things, I'm waiting for the day that the church makes some forward progress. So all of this brings us now to Bishop Fabian Breskowitz of Lincoln, who just retired, and he's one of the things that's holding us back. All right, he's one of those guys. He's one of those old school. He's 77, for God's sake. And when my brother and sister-in-law got married in a Lincoln church, we had their cousins sang for us, and the cousins who happened to be girls. And oh, guess what? They weren't allowed to sing on. They couldn't, because women can't touch the altar in a Lincoln church, apparently. Oh, it was so infuriating. And so here, his cousins had to spend almost the entire ceremony standing backstage behind a screen, so they wouldn't dirty the altar with their female presence. I was disgusted by that at the time. And that's all the doing of Bishop Breskowitz, who is no longer a part of that diocese, thank goodness. And similar things from him, that just very old school, very, very non-progressive, if you would. Whereas in the Omaha diocese that we're a part of, that not only are women allowed on the altar, we have altar girls, all right? Back in the day, it used to be just the altar boys that helped with the serving and all of this stuff. Now, we've got altar girls now, too, which, as Father Witt explained, and as a later priest explained to me, that being an altar boy has always been considered one of the first steps on the road to becoming a priest. And it was always encouraged that all boys had a chance to serve at least once to get a feel for it, to see if they had a calling, to know if this was something appropriate to them. And so it's always been considered the first step on the road to priesthood. And then, you know, that if that's going to be your calling, this is one of the ways that you might find out. And the idea that we allow girls to serve on the altar as well just indicates that, yeah, we're getting ready for that time, that we're getting ready for, you know, that we're showing that, yes, females can serve as well. And I'm hoping and praying it'll take one more pope. Benedict is never going to do it for us, because I love John Paul too.
the man was wonderful and progressive and ahead of his time as far as the Catholic Church goes. He was way behind the times compared to most of the modern world, but way ahead of the Catholic Church on a lot of things. I mean, you know, and it's not just, you know, apologizing to Galileo for the horrendous actions of the Church and similar wrongs that he tried to set right, at least in some small way. But it's even things like, you know, letting us know that evolution is not against the teachings of the Bible in the eyes of the Catholic Church. That you know, there's some conditions he puts on it that, you know, even if you're going to study and teach evolution, you still have to admit that, you know, God is still the ultimate creator and motivator of all things, this kind of stuff. But having been on the wrong side of science several times, John Paul II was smart enough to know that you know what? The Church isn't going to make any headway trying to contradict science. Science is truth and reality, and we need to work within that. And so he made the point that, that, you know, there's nothing that says that we can't teach evolution. There's nothing that says that we can't teach the Big Bang, that we can't teach these. These are all things that have basis in scientific study, and there's nothing wrong with Catholics believing that. There's nothing wrong with Catholics pursuing that as a course of study. And it's very progressive. And I tell that to Catholics nowadays, and I have a tough time getting people to believe me. That I will tell, because something will come up, and I obviously believe very strongly in evolution, and I will come up with against an acquaintance who is a creationist, and they'll start giving me garbage about it, and I'll say, well, yeah, but you realize that the Catholic Church, these are Catholics I'm talking about, and I'll say, well, you realize that the Pope said that there's nothing wrong with pursuing this as a study, that there's nothing in evolution that necessarily contradicts Catholic belief, and they simply refuse to believe me. And so then I have to go online, and I have to pull it up, and I have to show them where, see, this is where the Pope wrote it. This is, he wrote it and put a papal seal on the darn thing. Enough of my waxing poetic about Pope John Paul II. Pope Benedict, not nearly so progressive, not nearly so fun. We're going to have to wait for him to pass on before something is going to move forward. But, you know, maybe in 10 years, get a new Pope, start moving forward a little bit again, and maybe we'll start seeing those women priests. Maybe we'll start seeing some changes. But, okay, I've babbled on about religion enough for one day. We're good. You know what we need now? Oh, you know what? I was going to do a whole segment on George Takei, and I'm not going to. I'll save that for next week. Instead, let's do the badass movie quote of the week. Okay, this week's quote, since I'm on the whole religion kick, is from the movie The Avengers, when Mark Ruffalo, as the CGI Hulk, finishes. Oh, should I give away the spoiler? Anyway, after his extremely dramatic scene with Loki, Hulk looks down at him and says, "Puny God." Oh, one of my favorite movie moments of all time. Love that scene. Love The Avengers. Love everything about it. Joss Whedon can write me a superhero movie any damn day of the week. I love that man. He is great. But having finished the fastest badass movie quote of the week ever, let's go straight to the Pod-O-Matic! Hot dog, this is the Nerd Pride Radio Pod-O-Matic. At the end of every cast, I bring out R2 and his fully pimped out Pod-O-Matic bubble, and he rolls up random topics for me to talk about. And where these topics come from, you ask? Well, that is where you come in. You want to hear me haver on about something? You send your question or your topic to me by email, or better yet, don't send an email. What are we talking about? Send it to me in a private message on our forums, and I will add it to my Pod-O-Matic list. Pod-O-Matic is about whatever you want it to be. And our first number this week is 22. Thank you, R2. From Stan. Stan says, "Ever played Diplomacy or other games that encourage backstabbing?" Oh, I've always wanted to play Diplomacy. I always have, and I've never done it. I've played backstabbing games. I've played Paranoia, obviously. I've played Munchkin, a intern role-playing game and card game that both involve much, much backstabbing. And I love it. I love that kind of game. It's so much fun. I couldn't do it consistently, but they make a great diversion. They're awesome. But not Diplomacy. Diplomacy is a full-on board game that involves stabbing other people in the back. And I love that. I mean, we've always had some of that when we played Axis and Allies, even when we played Risk, that you'd make, if you can get four, five, six people at the table for a game like that, we had places where we would make deals with people and you'd make alliances and then later go back on them and be very vicious and ruthless. But not to the level where it is an integral part of the game itself, where it's actually built into the board game. Never done that. Number 89, Dire Cat. Hey, Dire. Would you rather be in extreme heat or extreme cold? Dude, cold. I mean, it's not, neither one of them is as pleasant as you'd want it to be. But if I had the choice, I'd rather have it be too cold than too hot. Simply because there's lots of things I can do to warm up, bundle up, put on the layers, do whatever you need to do. Once you get overheated, if you don't have air conditioning, it's much harder to cool back down. So for me, I prefer the cold. I prefer a chilly autumn day to midsummer any day of the week. But again, you're saying extreme heat or extreme cold. Would I rather freeze to death or have the flesh charred from my bones? Ooh, neither one sounds pleasant. Still rather freeze to death, I think. Then you just quietly go to sleep. Much less painful than being set on fire. So, yeah, either way you go. Yeah, cold. Number 92, Mr. Zimnipot. And he asks, do frogs have ears? Well, I assume they do. They hear. Yeah, look, wait a minute. Do frogs have ears? Maybe. I'm sure that frogs can hear. Although I'm not, you know what? Not 100% certain on that, but I'm pretty sure. Because most vertebrates can hear. So, just because I can't see an ear doesn't mean, I mean, I couldn't see an ear on my parakeet, but he heard me just fine and he could mimic my voice and talk. My Quaker parakeet, by the way, not a little budgie. I didn't see any ears on the bird, but he certainly heard me just fine. So, all right, let's talk to Google. We'll find out if frogs have ears. Just a second. All right, here we are. Wiki Answers tells me frogs do not have ears on the outside of their bodies that direct sound inward to an eardrum, as we see in humans and many other animals. However, they do have an eardrum, an inner ear, and a brain. Most frogs have a middle ear as well. And they hear with these structures as well as with their lungs. Okay, there you go. So yes, a frog can hear. Frog does not have ears. Answer your question. 37. From Brasky. Hey, Brasky. Brasky says, what's the deal with level-draining powers on D&D monsters anyways? Too overpowered, right? Game breaker, right? Totally lame-ia. Oh, lame-ia. You're awesome. All right. Actually, sort of. I don't like level-draining powers just because I don't like level-draining powers. And in earlier versions of the game, horrifying. Horrifying that you would lose a level, and that meant you lost a level. Holy crap! I played, because when we got serious about D&D when I was a kid, we played long games. A level was months at a time. All right, nowadays, you know, people expect to pick up a new level every, you know, four or five sessions, and that you're going to progress from zero to hero over the course of, you know, a year or two of play. And we didn't do that. We played a more character-focused story for a long time, and levels were few and far between. And so to lose a level represented a loss of, you know, 6 months of play. It was horrifying. And we played all the time. And so I'd never used level-draining monsters, or if I did, I kind of Dungeon Master fudged it so that things didn't get too bad. But now in the modern game, playing Pathfinder, instead of losing levels, you're picking up negative levels, and you know, then you get saving throws and extra saving throws, and you can get your stuff back through restoration. So hopefully if you're high enough level to be facing off, or stupid enough to be facing off with level-draining monsters, hopefully that means you're high enough level to have access to restoration or other aids that can help you get those levels back if you fail your saving throws. I actually wound up placing my players up against a succubus recently, who drained the living crap out of one of their dudes, completely seduced him, took him to bed, The other guys finally realized something was amiss, and they went and broke into the bedroom before it was too late. And so they had to rescue him naked and, you know, missing four levels, and drag him out of there. And he wound up actually being very fortunate with his saving throws, so his negative levels didn't last too terribly long. One of the next places they were getting to was an encampment of a permanent encampment of crusaders at the border of demon territory. So, that if he had not made his saving throws as well as he did, it would have cost them all of their cash, but they could have eventually have found a priest, a healer, somebody who could have helped them out for the right amount of money. But again, I threw that up against them knowing that they were a high enough level that, okay, he's got decent saving throws, and if the saving throws fail, they've got the resources if they're smart enough to seek them out. I mean, yes, it's entirely possible that the negative levels could have wound up being permanent if they had screwed it up. And that's the chance you take. But in, you know, it wasn't as big a risk as it sounds like, you know, you can play it smart. Number 34, a Mr. Serious Paul. And Serious Paul says, ever see the Ghostbusters cartoon where vampires fight werewolves? No! But, so you're telling me that the Ghostbusters cartoon invented Underworld. That is cool. I would love to have seen that. Now, wait. Now, was it the Ghostbusters based on the movies, or was it the original Ghostbusters? Not that it matters to me. I've never seen either one and don't really care that much. But I'm just curious. So, wow. I would love to have seen that, Paul. Number 98. Hey, Zimnipot again. Zim asks, what is the single best decision you've made in your life so far? Marrying my wife. How tough is that? I love her. We have an awesome marriage. We have four awesome, wonderful kids. Next summer, we will have been married for 20 years. I don't regret a moment of it. Absolutely, absolutely the best decision I ever made. Number 76. This is from Brasky. Brasky says, okay, assume you've been given green light to use any existing superhero or superheroes in a movie, but you also need to cast Peter Dinklage as the lead super role. What movie are you going to make? So I am contractually obligated to cast Peter Dinklage, whom I love, by the way. Peter Dinklage is awesome. This one's easy. I am going to make an Alpha Flight movie. Yeah, that's right, baby. I'm going to make an Alpha Flight movie because I love Alpha Flight. I've always loved Alpha Flight from the very beginning. They're Canadian heroes who aren't Wolverine. Therefore, not overrated and stupid. I love Alpha Flight. I love the original, and we collected from issue number one up through God knows how high that went before we finally gave up. And then collected the second Alpha Flight series from number one on up and had a great time with that one too. But here's the deal. You do Alpha Flight as a movie, and you can pick and choose because they've got enough of the history. You pick and choose the ones who are going to make the most awesome cinematic heroes. And you put in Peter Dinklage as Puck, obviously. And then you give Puck the central narrative role in the movie. So therefore, he gets to be our lead because he can be the motivator that kind of brings everything together. I always saw Puck as kind of a voice of wisdom in that team. I always loved him as kind of the Ben Kenobi, really. He wasn't horribly powerful, especially compared to some of the other people on the team. Guardian, later Vindicator, Sasquatch. These are people that can tear it up. And, well, all right, he was better than Marina. She was, I mean, seriously, a feral version of Aquaman. That's not really helping me. But Puck could be given an even stronger role in the movie of being, while yes, Guardian is technically our leader, and all of this comes from a Canadian government project, and it's under their auspices and Guardian's direction originally, Puck can be the motivator behind that. He can be the guy that keeps this group together. And when things get bad halfway through the movie and we're wondering if this project was even worth our time at all, are we creating more pain and more suffering than we're helping? You know, maybe we should just disband. Maybe we just need to let it go. No, Puck is the one that's going to rally them and give the John Blutarsky Animal House speech that gets everybody back together and gets them moving. Peter Dinklage would be spectacular as Puck. He would be so good at that. And we'd have to, I don't know if we'd have to give him, you have to give Peter Dinklage a bodysuit to play Puck, because Puck is built, in the comic books, they draw him as, you know, he's got shoulders and arms like the Hulk on this little tiny no-leg body. And Peter Dinklage is not proportioned the same way. But, you know, hey, if we can make Mark Ruffalo the Hulk, we can certainly make Peter Dinklage into Puck. I don't think this is much of a stretch for us. And he'd be so good at it.
Remember when the platform was sliding into the fire pit and I said goodbye, and you were like,
no way.
And then I was all, we pretended we were going to murder you.
That was great.
This podcast is copyright 2012 by Nerd Pride Radio. Our theme music is Death Metal Disco by Ian Kronk. The bumper music this week was, Sam Cooke with Wonderful World, and, William Shatner with She Blinded Me with Science. If you feel like doing something nice for this podcast, head on over to iTunes, write me a nice review, or if you want to contact me, you can always, I can't believe I've got these in the wrong order. I have been reading these credits for how long? How many times have I done this? Well, this will be the 38th, and how do I have them written in the wrong order? Let me try this again. First off, I told you who the bumper music was. If you like those, go over to iTunes and check them out. They're available. I personally love them. I wouldn't include them in my podcast if I didn't love them, or something to that effect. I can't believe I don't have this written. All right, let's see. If you feel like doing something nice for the podcast, head on over to iTunes and write a nice review, or check out our Facebook page at facebook.com/nerdprideradio. Then back up a line. If you want to contact me, you could always email me at mike@nerdprideradio.com, but we all know that that's not going to work. To be totally honest, the absolute best way to get a hold of me is come sign up for the forums at nerdprideradio.com/forums. Sign up, send me a message, we'll hang out together, we'll have fun! See how much better that was? Number 47, Brasky. Brasky says, I spit like bacon. I am made with an egg. I have plenty of backbone, but lack a good leg. I peel layers like onions, but still remain whole. I am long like a flagpole, yet fit in a hole. What am I? You'd be a snake. I peel layers. Oh, yeah, snakes shed their skin. Yeah, you'd be a snake, dude. That was too easy. Let's do another one. Number 12. Brasky again. Oh, good. You got another shot. Brasky says, hey, man, I've recently started playing the Hollywood Stock Exchange again. It's so awesome. He has like 9 O's in there. So awesome. Why don't you join again? Hey, if anyone's up for that, HSX.com, the Hollywood Stock Exchange. Go sign up. They will give you $2 million free Play Hollywood dollars with which you can invest in movie stocks and movie star bonds, and their prices go up and down based on speculation and then get readjusted based on the performance of the various movies that they're in, blah, 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 blah. You can make lots of fake money and have a really good time. I played this game 12 years ago, longer than that, and at that time, Brasky got me into the game back then as well, and I was obsessed. I could not stop playing that game. It was every single movie. You guys know me. I already have an obsession with movies, all right? This just drove it over the top. I knew every movie that was going to be opening for the next 2 months. I was following their trends. I knew the opening weekends of every movie for the previous 3 years, all right? I could tell you how much money they had made on their opening weekends, how well that adjusted from week to week, the poor performers, the good performers. I knew which stars were big. Not only did I know all that, I had charts. I had Excel spreadsheets packed with all this information. I had 12 different websites that I visited to gather new information, and I compiled them into charts. I tried to find long-term trends, analyzing movie performances and various stars. It was crazy. It was crazy. crazy. And this was, look, at the time, I only had one kid, and he was very, very little, so I didn't have the same sort of commitments I do now. And it was like getting obsessed with a particular video game. It's like people who get hooked on World of Warcraft and they can't get out of the game. They have to play every moment. That's what Hollywood Stock Exchange was for me. I was spending a good portion of my waking hours on the computer, staying up way too late at night, doing research on movies so that I could win fake money when the next set of movies opened. It was terrible. Oh my God. And, one of the things that killed me about it is I was invested in The Matrix before it was big. I was invested in what was to become Avatar ultimately. I was invested in that and held a ton of money in it, and it turns out that thing never panned out and never panned out and never panned out. Well, then finally, a million years later, I'm not even anywhere near the game anymore, and now Avatar comes out, and it's the biggest thing that ever existed. Not that it would have been worth it to hold it at that time. That's a sucker bet. Your money's going to be better invested well along the way and then get in. Anyway, see, this is what it does to you. All right, now, here's the magic of Hollywood Stock Exchange. Here's how evil and insidious it is. I played Hollywood Stock Exchange. I was obsessed over it. I finally decided that this is too much. I've got to quit. There's no way. I've got to get out of here. Okay, so I did. But then I went back. Because, you know, it's right there. Look, I've been off it for a few days, and I'm just going to go in just to check and see what the total looks like. I don't even care, really. At this point, look, the stuff's going to sit there, it can rot for all I care. But let's just go look. Oh, crap. I didn't know that was there. Hold on, let's invest in some of this. Oh, and it kept sucking me back in. So ultimately, I went out, and this was before passwords were so easily retrievable when you screwed them up and lost them. I had to go in and tell it I had a new email address. And then after telling it I had a new email address, which didn't exist, by the way, I then went and changed my password. I had to write it down because you have to confirm it. You have to do your new password and then confirm your new password. So I wrote down a string of 20 nonsense characters that there's no way I would ever be able to memorize them. All right, so I entered my new password. I confirmed my new password. I hit go, so the password has changed. And then I tore my password into little bits, and I ate it. I ate it. Now, I didn't have to eat it. I could have burned it, or I could have just torn it into little bits and thrown it in the trash. I could have flushed them down the toilet. But no, I had to eat it. I had to, because there was something about that game that required that, required me to make this final break and really just walk away from it. Now, Brasky is inviting me back into the game, and I know he's playing. He's posted up online. He's trying to lure me back in. And I think if I played now, I don't have the same kind of time to be obsessive. I wouldn't get to that level because I would just... The first time, it was a slow building process. Oh, you play a little bit, you have a little interest in it, whatever. And then as time builds up, you keep investing more and more around the edges and adding new stuff to it until finally you realize that it's consuming all of your time. I don't think I'd let it get to that point again because I simply don't have the time to build up to it. I have so many other things that I'd want to do online. I don't think I would get to that one. But I'm not taking that chance, dude. That thing was scary. So, as much as I really enjoyed the Hollywood Stock Exchange while I was on it, and if other people want to go check it out, dude, $2 million free fake dollars. How can you pass up $2 million free fake dollars? Go try it out. Go ahead. I'll wait. But I can't do it myself.